This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents High Druid of Shannara, Tanaquil, by Terry Brooks. Read by Paul Bamer. Chapter 1. Sen Dunsedain, Prime Minister of the Federation, paused to look back over his shoulder as he reached his sleeping chambers. There was no one there who shouldn't be. His personal guard at the bedroom doorway, the sentries on watch at both ends of the hallway, no one else. There never was. But that didn't stop him from checking every night. His eyes scanned the torchlit corridor carefully. It didn't hurt to make certain. It only made sense to be careful. He entered and closed the door softly behind him. The warm glow and sweet candle smells that greeted him were reassuring. He was the most powerful man in the Southland, but not the most popular. That hadn't bothered him before the coming of the Ilswitch, but it hadn't stopped bothering him since. Even though she was finally gone, banished to a realm of dark madness and bloodlust from which no one had ever escaped, he did not feel safe. He stood for a moment and regarded his reflection in the full-length mirror that was backed against the wall opposite his bed. The mirror had been placed there for other reasons, for a witnessing of satisfactions and indulgences that might as well have happened in another lifetime, so distant did they seem to him now. He could have them still, of course, but he knew they would give him no pleasure. Hardly anything pleasured him these days. His life had become an exercise conducted with equal measures of grim determination and iron will. Political practicalities and expediencies motivated everything he did. Every act, every word had ramifications that reached beyond the immediate. There was no time or place for anything else. In truth, there was no need. His reflection stared back at him, and he was mildly shocked to see how old he had become. When had that happened? He was in the prime of his life, sound of mind and body, at the apex of his career, arguably the most important man in the four lands. Yet, look what he had become. His hair had gone almost white. His face, once smooth and handsome, was lined and careworn. There were shadows in places where his worries had gathered like stains. He stood slightly stooped, where once he had stood erect. Nothing about him reflected confidence or strength. He seemed to himself a shell from which the contents of life had been drained. He turned away. Fear and self-loathing would do that. He had never recovered from what the Morgar had put him through the night he had drained the lives from all those freeborn captives brought out of the Federation prisons. He had never forgotten what it had felt like to watch them become the living dead, creatures for which life had no meaning beyond that assigned by the warlock. Even after the Morgar had been destroyed, the memory of that night lingered, a whisper of the madness waiting to consume him if he strayed too far from the safety of the pretense and dissembling that kept him sane. Becoming Prime Minister had imbued him with a certain measure of respect from those he led, but it was less willingly bestowed these days than it had been in the beginning, when his people still had hope that he might accomplish something. That hope had long since vanished into the rocks and earth of the Precandoran, where so many had shed their blood and lost their lives. It had vanished with his failure not only to end the war that had consumed the four lands for the better part of 3 decades, but even to bring it closer to a meaningful conclusion. It had vanished in his failure to enhance the prestige of the Federation in the eyes of those for whom the Southland mattered, leaving bitterness and disappointment as the only legacy he could expect should he die on the morrow. He walked to his bed and sat down, reached automatically for the goblet that had been placed on his bedside table, and filled it from the pitcher of wine that accompanied it. He took a long drink, thinking that at least he had managed to rid himself of the intolerable presence of Grianne Ohmsford. The hated Ilswitch was gone at last. With Shedeia Aru as his ally, even as treacherous as she was, he had a reasonable chance of ending the stalemates that had confronted him at every turn for the last 20 years. Theirs was a shared vision of the world's future, one in which Federation and Druids controlled the destinies and dictated the fates of all the races. Together, they would find a way to bring an end to the freeborn Federation War and a beginning to Southland dominance. Although it hadn't happened yet, and nothing he could point to suggested it would happen anytime soon, Shedeia's failure to bring the Druid Council into line was particularly galling. He was beginning to wonder if their alliance was one-sided. She had the benefit of his open support, and he, as yet, had nothing. Thus, he was forced to look over his shoulder still, because doubt lingered and resistance to his leadership grew. He had just emptied his goblet and was thinking of filling it anew when a knock sounded at his door. He jumped in spite of himself. Once, an unexpected silence would have startled him. Those he feared most, the Ill's Witch and the Morgor, would not have bothered to knock. Now, every little sound caused the iron bands that wrapped his chest and heart to tighten further. He gave them a moment to loosen, then stood, setting the empty goblet carefully on the table beside him.
"Who is it?"
"Apologies, Prime Minister," came the voice of his captain of the guard. "A visitor wishes a word with you, one of your engineers. He insists it is most urgent, and from the look of him, I would judge it to be so."
A pause.
"He is unarmed and alone."
Dunsadan straightened. An engineer? At this time of night? He had a number of them working on his airships, all of them assigned to find ways to make the component pieces of his fleet work more efficiently. But few, if any, would presume to try to talk to him directly, especially so late at night. He was immediately suspicious, but reconsidered as he realized that an attempt to see him under these conditions indicated a certain amount of desperation. He was intrigued. He put aside his reservations and irritation and stepped to the door.
"Enter." The engineer slid through the doorway in the manner of a ferret to its hole. He was a small man who lacked any distinguishing physical characteristics. The way he held himself as he faced Sen Dunsadan suggested that he was a man who recognized that it was important not to overstep.
"Prime Minister,"
he said, bowing low and waiting.
"You have something urgent to speak to me about."
"Yes, Prime Minister. My name is Orek. Eaton Orek. I have served as an airship engineer for more than 20 years. I am your most loyal servant and admirer, Prime Minister, and so I knew that I must come directly to you when I made my discovery."
He was still bent over, not presuming to address Sen Dunsadan as an equal. There was a cringing quality to his posture that bothered the Prime Minister, but he forced himself to ignore it.
"Stand up and look at me."
Eaton Orek did so, though his effort at meeting Sen Dunsadan's practiced gaze failed, his eyes preferring to fix on the other's belt buckle.
"I apologize for disturbing you."
"What sort of discovery have you made, Engineer Orek? I gather this has something to do with your work on my airships."
The other nodded quickly.
"Oh, yes, Prime Minister, it does. I've been working on diapsin crystals, trying to find ways to enhance their performance as converters of ambient light to energy. That has been my task for the better part of the past 5 years."
"And so?"
Orek hesitated.
"My lord,"
he said, switching to the more formal and deferential title,
"I think it best if I show you rather than tell you. I think you will better understand."
He brushed at his mop of unruly dark hair and rubbed his hands together nervously.
"Would it be too much of an imposition to ask you to come with me to my workstation? I know it is late, but I think you will not be disappointed."
For a moment, Sen Dunsadan considered the possibility that this might be an assassination attempt. But he dismissed the idea.
His enemies would surely come up with a better plan than this if they were serious about eliminating him. This little man was too fearful to be the instrument of a prime minister's death. His presence was the result of something else, and much as he hated to admit it, Sen Dunsadan was increasingly interested in finding out what it was.
You realize that if this is a waste of my time, there will be unpleasant consequences, he said softly.
Eaton Auric's eyes snapped up to meet his, suddenly bold. I am hoping that a reward will be more in order than a punishment, Prime Minister.
Dunsadan smiled, in spite of himself. The little man was greedy, a quality he appreciated in those who sought his favor. Fair enough. He would give him his chance at fame and fortune.
Lead the way, Engineer. Let us see what you have discovered.
They went out the door of the bedchamber and into the hallway beyond. Instantly, Sen Dunsadan's personal guard fell into step behind them, warding his back against attack, lending him fresh confidence, just by their presence. There had never been an assassination attempt against him, although he had uncovered a few plots that might have led to one. Each time, those involved had been made to disappear, always with an explanation passed quietly by word of mouth. The message to everyone was made clear. Even talk of removing the Prime Minister from office would be regarded as treason and dealt with accordingly. Still, Sen Dunsadan was not so complacent as to think that an attempt would not be made eventually. He would be a fool to think otherwise, given the restless state of his government and the discontent of his people. If an assassination attempt were successful, those responsible would not be condemned for their acts. Those who took his place would reward them. It was a narrow, twisting path he trod, and he was aware of the dangers it held. A healthy measure of caution was always advisable. Yet that night, he did not feel such caution necessary. He couldn't explain his conclusion other than to tell himself that his instincts did not require it, and his instincts were almost always correct. This little man he followed, this Eaton Auric, was after something other than the removal of the Prime Minister. He had come forward very deliberately when few others would have dared to do so, and for him to do that, he had to have very specific plans and, in all likelihood, a very specific goal. It would be interesting to discover both, even if it proved necessary to kill him afterwards. They passed through the Prime Minister's residential halls to the front entry, where another set of black-cloaked guards stood, waiting, backs straight, pikes gleaming in the torchlight.
Bring the coach around, Sen Dunsadan ordered.
He stood, waiting just inside the door with Eaton Auric, watching as the other shifted anxiously from foot to foot and cast his eyes everywhere but on his host. Every so often it appeared he might speak, but then he apparently thought better of it. Just as well. What would they talk about after all? It wasn't as if they were friends. After tonight, they would probably never speak again. One of them might even be dead. By the time the coach rolled into the courtyard beyond the iron-bound entry doors, Sen Dunsadan was growing impatient with the entire business. It was taking a lot of effort to do what his engineer had asked, and there was no reason in the world to think the trouble would be worthwhile. But he had come this far, and there was no point in dismissing the matter until he knew for certain that it merited dismissal. Stranger things had happened over the years. He would wait before passing final judgment. They boarded the coach, his guards taking up positions on the running board to either side and on the front and rear seats outside the cab. The horses snorted in response to the driver's commands, and the coach lurched ahead through the darkness. The compound was quiet, and only the lights that burned in a scattering of windows indicated the presence of the other ministers of the Coalition Council and their families. Outside the compound walls, the streets roughened, smells sharpened, and sounds rose as a result of the greater numbers housed there. Overhead, the moon was a bright,
unclouded orb in the firmament, shining down on Arisheg with such intensity that the city lay clearly revealed. On nights like this, the Prime Minister thought darkly, magic often happened. The trick was in recognizing if such magic was good or bad. At the airship field on the north edge of the city, Eaton Auric directed them to one of the smaller buildings, a block-shaped affair that sat beyond the others and clearly was not used to house anything so grand as a flying vessel. A sentry on watch came out to greet them, clearly confused and intimidated by the unexpected appearance of the Prime Minister. He nevertheless hastened ahead of the entourage to unlock the doors to the building. Once there, the engineer led the way, indicating a long corridor barely lit by lamps at each end, the spaces between dark stains and shadowed indentations. Two of Sen Dunsadan's guards moved ahead, taking note of each place in which an assassin might hide, close on the heels of an impatient Eaton Auric. Halfway down a second corridor, the engineer stopped before a small door and gestured. "In here, Prime Minister." He opened the door and let the guards enter first, their bulky forms disappearing at once into shadow. Inside, they fired torches set in wall brackets, and by the time Sen Dunsadan entered, the room was brightly lit. The Prime Minister looked around doubtfully. The room was a maze of tables and workbenches piled high with pieces of equipment and materials. Racks of tools hung from the walls, and shards of metal of all sizes and shapes littered the floor. He saw several crates of diapsin crystals, the lids pried open, the crystals' faceted surfaces winking in the flicker of the torchlight. Everything in the room seemed to have been scattered about in haphazard fashion, and with little concern for what it might take to find it later. Sen Dunsadan looked at Eaton Auric.
"Well, Engineer Auric?"
"My lord," the other replied, bowing his way forward until he stood very close, too close for the Prime Minister's comfort. "It would be better if you saw this alone," he whispered. Sen Dunsadan leaned forward slightly.
"Send my guards away, you mean? Isn't that asking a little bit more than you should?"
The little man nodded. "I swear to you, Prime Minister, you will be perfectly safe." The sharp eyes glanced up quickly. "I swear." Sen Dunsadan said nothing. "Keep them with you if you feel the need," the other continued quickly, then paused. "But you may have to kill them later if you do." Dunsadan stared at him.
"Nothing you could show me would merit such treatment of the men in whose hands I daily place my life. You presume too much, Engineer."
Again, the little man nodded. "I implore you, send them away. Just outside the door will do, just so they don't see what I have to show you." His breathing had quickened. "You will still have them within call. They can be at your side in a moment should you feel you need them, but they will also be safely away should you decide you don't."
For a long moment, Sen Dunsadan held the other's gaze without speaking, then nodded.
"As you wish, little man. But don't be fooled into thinking I have no way to defend myself should you try to play me false. If I even think you are trying to betray me, I will strike you dead before you can blink."
Eaton Auric nodded. An unmistakable mix of fear and anticipation glittered in his eyes. Whatever it was, this business was important to him. He was willing to risk everything to see it through. Such passion worried Sen Dunsadan, but he refused to let it rule him.
"Guards," he called, "leave us. Close the door. Wait just outside where you can hear me if I summon you."
The guards did as they were told. Once there would have been hesitation at such a request. Now, after having survived a handful of unpleasant examples resulting from such hesitation, they obeyed without question. It was the way Sen Dunsadan preferred them. When the door was closed, he turned again to Eaton Auric.
"This had best be worth my time, Engineer. My patience is growing short.
The little man nodded vigorously, running his hand through his dark hair as he led the way to the far end of the room and a long table piled high with debris. Grinning conspiratorially, he began to clean away the debris, revealing a long, black box sectioned into three pieces.
"I have been careful to keep my work hidden from everyone," he explained quickly. "I was afraid they might steal it, or worse, sell it to the enemy. You never know."
He finished clearing the table of everything but the box, then faced Sen Dunsedain once more.
"My assigned task for the past 3 years has been to seek new and better ways in which to convert ambient light into energy. The purpose, as I am sure you are aware, is to increase the thrust of the vessels in combat conditions so that they might better outmaneuver their attackers. All my efforts to readapt a single crystal failed. The conversion is a function of the crystal's composition, its shaping, and its placement in the parse tube. A single crystal has a finite capability for conversion of light into energy, and there is nothing I have found that will alter that."
He nodded, as if to reassure himself that he was right about this.
"So I abandoned that approach and began to experiment with multiple crystals. You see, Prime Minister, I reasoned that if one crystal would produce a certain amount of energy, then two working together might double that figure. The trick, of course, is in finding how to channel the ambient light from one crystal to the next without losing power."
Sen Dunsedain nodded, suddenly interested. He thought he understood now why Eason Auric had been so anxious to bring him there. Somehow, the engineer had solved the dilemma that had plagued the Federation for years. He had found a way to increase the power generated by the diapsin crystals used in his airships.
"At first," the other went on, "all of my attempts failed. The crystals, when I found a way to place them so that their facets transferred their converted energy from one to the other, simply exploded in the tubes. The additional power was too much for any one of them to handle. So then I began working to combine more than two, attempting to find a different way to channel their energy in a manner that was not so direct and less likely to incur damage."
"You were successful?"
Sen Dunsedain could not contain himself. Eaton Auric's insistence on dragging out this business was wearing on him.
"You found a way to increase the amount of thrust?"
The little man shook his head and smiled.
"I found something else. Something better."
He walked over to the torches and extinguished them one by one until only those by the door were still burning. Then he moved to the box and raised its hinged lid, revealing a series of diapsin crystals of varying sizes and shapes that were nested in metal cradles throughout the three sections of the box. The crystals had been arranged in sequence from small to large and in lines, but each one was blocked, front and back, by a shield carefully cut to its individual size. Narrow rods that crisscrossed the chambers like spider webs connected all the shields. Auric stepped aside so that Sen Dunsedain could peer inside. The Prime Minister did so, but could make no sense of what he was seeing.
"This is what you brought me to see?" he snapped.
"No, Prime Minister,"
the other replied.
"I brought you to see this."
He pointed to the far end of the room where a piece of heavy metal armor was fixed to the wall. Then he pointed down again toward the very rear of the box where dark canvas draped an object Sen Dunsedain had overlooked. Eaton Auric smiled.
"Watch, my lord."
He lifted away the canvas to reveal a diapsin crystal that looked something like a multifaceted pyramid. The instant the canvas was removed, the pyramid began to glow a dull orange.
"You see?"
Auric pressed.
"It begins to gather ambient light. Now, watch."
Seconds later, he fastened his fingers about the crisscrossed rods and snatched away the network of shields. Instantly, light erupted from the pyramid crystal and ricocheted through all the other crystals in the box, brightening them one by one with the same dull orange glow. Swiftly, the light built, traveling down the length of the box from crystal to crystal, gathering power. Then, with an audible explosion, the light shot through a narrow aperture at the front of the box in a thin ribbon of fire that struck the piece of armor at the far end of the room. The metal erupted in a shower of sparks and flames, and then began to melt as the light burned a fist-size hole right through its center and into the wall beyond. Swiftly, Eaton Auric pulled on a rod attached to the cradle in which the rear crystal rested, taking it out of line in the sequence. At once, the other crystals began to lose their power and their light began to fail. The engineer waited a few moments, then dropped the connecting shields back into place and recovered the rear crystal with the canvas. He turned to send Dunsadan and did not miss the look of shock on the Prime Minister's face.
"You see?" he repeated eagerly. "You see what it is?"
"A weapon," Dunsadan whispered, still not quite believing what he had witnessed. At the far end of the room, the piece of target metal was still red-hot and smoking. As he stared at it, he envisioned a free-born airship in its place. "A weapon," he repeated. Eaton Auric stepped close.
"I have told no one else. Only you, my lord. I knew you would want it that way."
Sen Dunsadan nodded quickly, recovering his composure.
"You did well. You will have your reward and your recognition." He looked at the engineer. "How many of these do we have?"
The engineer looked pained.
"Only the one, Prime Minister. I have not been able to build another yet. It takes time to calculate the proper angle and refraction needed. No two crystals are exactly alike, so each of these boxes will have to be built separately."
He paused.
"But one may be more than enough to do what is needed. Consider, to power the crystals in this box, I used only the torchlight by the doorway, a small and feeble source. Think of the power that you will have at your command when the crystals are exposed to bright sunlight. Think of the range and sweep when you increase the field of fire. Did you notice? The light does not burn the aperture at the front of the box. That is because it is glass-fused, and the light does not burn the glass as it does the metal. It heats it, singes it, but does not destroy it. We control the power of our weapon accordingly."
Sen Dunsadan was barely listening, his thoughts racing ahead to what the discovery meant, to its vast possibilities, to the certainty he felt that in one bold stroke he could change the course of history. He was breathing hard, and it required an effort for him to calm himself enough to address his immediate concerns.
"You will tell no one of this, Eaton Auric," he instructed. "I will give you space and materials and a guard to allow you to work undisturbed. If you require help, you shall have it. You will report your progress to me, and to me alone. Your superiors will be instructed that you have been assigned to a project of a personal nature. I want you to build me as many of these weapons as you can, swiftly. If one is all you can manage, then one will have to do. But others would be most desirable and would enhance your reputation even further."
He placed his hand on the engineer's narrow shoulder.
"I see greatness in you. I see a life of fame and fortune. I see a position of responsibility that shall transcend anything you have ever dreamed about. Believe me, the importance of what you have accomplished is impossible to exaggerate."
Eaton Auric actually blushed.
"Thank you, Prime Minister. Thank you indeed."
Sen Dunsadan patted his shoulder reassuringly and departed the room. His waiting guards fell into step as he passed. Two he left stationed at the workroom door with strict orders to allow no one but himself to enter or leave. The engineer was to be kept under lock and key.
He was to take his meals in his workroom. He was to sleep there as well. He was to be allowed to come out once a day for an hour when everyone else had gone home, but at no other time. He was in his coach and riding back toward his bedchamber when he decided he would not have Eaton Auric killed right away. He would keep him alive until he had constructed at least a handful of these marvelous weapons. He would keep him alive until after the Freeborn army had been smashed and the Precandoran reclaimed. 6 weeks ought to be just long enough. Chapter 2. Dawn's faint silver tinge was creeping over the eastern horizon in a dull wash when Shadea Aru heard the tinkle of the bell. She was already awake, sitting at the desk in the chambers reserved for the Ard Rhys of the Druid Council. The chambers that had once belonged to Grian Ormsford, but now belonged to her. She was already awake because she could not sleep, preoccupied by her ever-shifting plans for the Order, and troubled by her inability to bring them to pass. Her lack of success wasn't entirely unexpected, of course. Even though the Ill's Witch had been enormously unpopular with the Druids in general, Shadea was not much better liked. She had alienated almost as many members of the Order as her predecessor, using her superior talents and physical prowess to intimidate and bully when she would have been better advised to use more subtle means. Now it was taking all of her efforts to persuade her followers that she had changed her ways and would be for them the understanding, concerned leader they all foolishly believed they needed. In the meantime, the Order languished. She had secured her hold on the office of the High Druid through the aid of her allies, especially Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz, either of whom was better suited to the role of diplomat than she was, and who together had worked tirelessly to bring as many Druids into line as they could manage. But the effectiveness of the Druid Council continued to be limited, its shadow no more intimidating or impressive than it had been with Grian Ormsford at its head. Still regarding the Order with distrust and disdain in equal measures, none of the nations or their governments spent a moment to consider the position of the Druids on any of the issues affecting the Four Lands. The sole exception was the Federation, but that was only because she had made Sen Dunsedain her ally early on, giving him the promise of the Order's backing to put a favorable end to the war on the Precandoran. Even the Prime Minister was in scant evidence these days, however, the leader of the powerful Federation having retired to Ardashaig with scarcely a word of communication since his announcement of support for her as acting Ard Rhys. That was not out of character for Sen Dunsedain, of course. His history as leader of the Coalition Council was notable for his behind-the-scenes manipulations and judicious absences. Long had he coveted his position, it was no secret. He had gotten it because his rivals had died, mysteriously, both on the same day, a coincidence too obvious to ignore. But in the years since he had realized his goal, he seemed less satisfied. Once a very public man, he now appeared rarely and only when it was unavoidable. She had endured his sly and condescending attitude on more than one occasion, but he seemed less sure of himself these days, less driven, and she thought that his secrets were beginning to erode his once unshakable confidence. Nevertheless, he was a valuable ally. If he chose to hide out in Ardashaig, it was of no matter, so long as his support of her was made open and obvious to all. The trick was in finding a way to persuade him to accommodate her. For now, there was the matter of the bell and what it signified. She rose from her desk and walked to the alcove window that opened north. On the ledge just outside the frame, she had constructed a platform and secured a wire cage for her carrier birds, the same species that Grian Ormsford had used when the chambers had been hers. The sound of the bell meant that the one she was expecting had finally returned. She opened the window
and peered inside the wire enclosure. The fierce, dark face of the Arrow Swift peered back at her, its sleek, swept-back wings folded into the sides of its distinctively narrow body, its right leg bound with the tiny message tube. She reached into the cage and stroked the bird familiarly, speaking soothingly, calming it. The birds imprinted on their owners early and never shifted their allegiance. She had been forced to destroy all her predecessors' birds because they were useless to her. Their loyalty was legendary, and like creatures that mate for life, they would not accept a new master. After a moment, she slipped the tube from the Swift's leg and brought it into the light. Unfastening the tip, she pulled out the tiny piece of paper inside and carefully unrolled it. The familiar block printing confirmed what she had suspected for days. Gallifile destroyed. Tarek Molt and Aran Elisadil dead. I track the boy. The scry waters had told them already of the destruction of the Gallifile, and she had assumed that Tarek Molt was gone as well, especially since there had been no word from him since. That Aran Elisadil was dead was the first positive piece of news she had received on the matter. She was more than pleased to have Grian Omsford's strongest ally out of the way. I track the boy. She felt a shiver of excitement at the words. Aphasia Y still hunted Pandaren Omsford. The boy was doomed. Once Aphasia began to hunt, there was no escape. It was only a matter of time. She had feared the assassin had perished in the conflagration that had consumed the Gallifile, and after days with no communication, she had dispatched the Arrow Swift to seek him out. It did not matter to her how he had survived, only that he had. She carried the tiny message back to her writing table and fed it into the flame of the candle. The paper blackened and curled and turned to ash. She bore the charred fragments back to the window, blew them into dust, and watched them drift away on the wind. Aphasia Y. She had found him quite by accident, an outcast and recluse living at the edge of the teeming, squalid hovels that encircled the city of Dectera. She had been in the last year of her service with the Federation, a big, strong woman with little fear and a burning ambition. Her introduction to Aphasia Y came about because she was looking for a certain deserter from the army, a man she knew well enough to dislike and stay clear of in other circumstances. But a rumor of his presence in the tenement sections of the city having surfaced, she was assigned to find and bring him back. She was given no choice in the matter. Aphasia Y, however, had found him first. A street child of unknown origins, Aphasia had grown up as something of a legend to those who populated the dark undersurface of Dectera. At some point in his early life, he had been badly disfigured, but not before he had been so severely mistreated that the damage to his physical appearance could not begin to approach the damage to his psyche. Emotionally and psychologically, he dwelled in a realm few others had ever occupied, dark and soulless and empty of feeling. If he had a code of conduct, Shadea had never been able to figure out what it was. That it involved killing as a ritual cleansing was something she learned when she went looking for the deserter. That it was quixotic and arbitrary became clear when she discovered that Aphasia felt an unexpected connection to her. His attraction to her might have had something to do with their similar backgrounds as orphans and children of the street, outcasts who had been forced to make their own way in the world. It might have something to do with their mutual acceptance of violence as a way of life. When she found out what he had done to the deserter, her only response had been to ask for a piece of the man to prove that he was dead. She had not sought an explanation of the circumstances. She had neither approved nor disapproved of the act. That might have impressed him. Then again, he might have recognized that she was drawn to him, finding his disfigurement both external and internal oddly attractive, as if surviving such damage was proof of his resiliency, of his worth. That he was repulsive to look upon, all crook-limbed and spider-like, did not matter to her. Nor did his penchant for mutilating and eviscerating his victims, which might well have reflected his own lack of self-esteem. In the world of the Federation Army, strength of heart and body counted for more than strength of character or physical appearance. Judgments were passed daily on the former and seldom on the latter. She found Aphasia Y admirable for his talents and cared nothing for the package in which those talents came wrapped. Killing was an art, and this man, this odd creature of the streets and darkness, had elevated it to a special form. She visited with him regularly after that, talking of death and dying, of killing and surviving, and their conversations confirmed that they were more alike than might appear to be the case on the face of things. He spoke in short, halting sentences, his voice the sound of crushed glass and dry leaves, intense and tinged with bitterness. He had no time for words with most people, yet found them pleasant when shared with her. He didn't say so, but she could feel it. He lacked friends, lacked a home, lacked anything approaching a normal existence, gnawing at the edges of civilization the way a rodent would a garbage pit. At first, she couldn't determine anything about his way of life. What did he do to stay alive? How did he spend his time? He wouldn't reveal such things, and she knew better than to press. It wasn't until he was sure of her, until he felt the connection between them to be strong enough, that he told her. He was a weapon for those who needed one and could afford to pay. He was a poison so lethal that no one he touched lived beyond that moment. Those who needed him found him through word of mouth spread on the streets. He came to them when he chose. They were never allowed to find him. He was an assassin, although he didn't call himself that yet. 2 years later, after she had decided to leave the Federation and pursue her ambitions elsewhere, she had been drugged and violated by a handful of men who wanted to make an example of her. Left for dead, she had recovered, tracked them down, and killed them all. Aphasia Y had helped her find them, though he knew better than to deprive her of the pleasure she took in watching them die. Afterwards, she had fled Dectera and the Southland for the protective isolation of Grimpen Ward and the Wilderun. Deep in the Westland, she had continued her study of magic in preparation for her journey to Paranor, where she intended to become one of the new druids. Within 2 months of her arrival, Aphasia Y appeared in Grimpen Ward as well. How he found her was a mystery she never solved, nor did it matter. In truth, she was glad to see him. He had followed her, he said, because he wanted to see what she was going to do. It was an odd way of putting things, but she understood. He wanted to share in the violence and upheaval in which she almost certainly intended to immerse herself. He understood her as well as she understood herself. There would be killing and death in her life, no matter where she went or what she did. It was in her nature. It was in his as well. He did not live with her or anywhere that would suggest they shared a relationship. He stayed on the periphery of her existence, surfacing only when she put out word for him, or when he sensed, as he was capable of doing, her need for him. When she met Iridia, Aphasia Y was the first person she introduced to the elven sorceress. It was a test of sorts. If Iridia was disturbed by Y, she would be of little use in more repellent situations. Iridia barely gave the assassin a second glance. She was made of the same stuff as Shadea and driven by the same relentless hunger. So the three of them had coexisted in Grimpen Ward until Shadea had come east to Paranor, bringing Iridia with her. Aphasia Y had been left behind very deliberately,
so as not to complicate her induction into the Druid Council. Later, when she was firmly established and there was need, she had sent for him. The others who had joined her conspiracy against the Ard Rhys, Tarek Molt, Pison Wentz, and Trant Rowan, instinctively disliked and mistrusted her dangerous friend. Molt called him a monster from the first. Wentz called him worse. Rowan, who had heard of him during his time in the Southland, kept his thoughts to himself. But when mention of Aphasia Y was made in his presence, his face betrayed him every time. All in all, it made Shadea Aru very happy to find them so unsettled by a man who answered only to her. She turned from the window of her sleeping chamber and walked back to her desk. There was a great deal she did not know about Aphasia Y. In truth, he unsettled her as well, at times. There was something subhuman about him, something so primal that it was irreconcilable with human nature. It was his gift to be so, a gift she was quick to take advantage of when confronted with difficult situations. Remorseless and inexorable, he never failed. She would have used him against the Ard Rhys had she not believed Grian Olmsford the more dangerous of the two and the one person besides herself who would be a match for him. But against the boy, she bent down to blow out the candles. It was late in the day, the assignment of duties given out and the members of the Druid Council dismissed to their rooms, when Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz appeared at the door to her chambers. She had not seen them since that morning when she had advised them of the message from Aphasia Y. Their response had been guarded, perhaps out of a sense of resignation that the unpleasant task of capturing the young boy was going to be carried out after all, perhaps out of a sense of futility they felt regarding the whole business. Neither had been overly supportive of the endeavor. It was as if they believed that eliminating Grian Olmsford was all that mattered, that beyond her removal lay green pastures and blue skies. They lack the fire of old, she thought, the passion that brought them into my circle of influence. But she didn't worry. They were still committed enough to do what was needed and not likely to disappear in a pointless rage as Iridia had done. Besides, she was already making plans for new alliances that would eliminate the necessity of maintaining the old. A message just reached us, Shadea. Trant Rowan began as soon as he had closed the door behind them. We have found the boy's parents. She felt a surge of elation. Everything was finally falling into place. Once they had the parents under their control, they could rest easy. There was no one else who would pursue the matter of the Ard Rhys disappearance, no one who cared enough to become involved. Kermadec might still be out there, or Tagwin, but neither possessed the magic of Beck Olmsford. He was the one who was dangerous. Where? She asked. In the Eastland. We have been searching that area ever since Molt discovered from the boy that his parents were on an expedition in the Anar. But no one had seen or heard anything until a week ago. Then a trader working the supply route along the Pass of Jade on the lower edge of Darkland Reach sold some goods to a man and woman piloting an airship named Swiftsure. They are the ones we seek. A week ago? Shadea frowned. Ah, but here is the thing. Pison Wentz interrupted eagerly. All this time we have been searching for them in the Wolfsktog Mountains, because that is where we assumed they were going. But that isn't where they have been. They have been exploring the Ravenshorn farther east and so deep into the Anar that no word has reached them of our search. We are fortunate, Shadea, that they still have no idea of what has happened to their son, or we would have lost them for sure. Have they no idea now? Wentz shook his head. None. We learned of it by accident, our spies making inquiries everywhere until they found the trader.
He, of course, had no idea of the value of his information and gave it willingly to those who did. So now we have their location. What do we do?
She walked to her window and stood looking out, thinking it through.
She must be careful. Unlike the boy, Beck Ohmsford possessed enough magic to incinerate anyone foolish enough to give him reason to do so. He would not be easily disposed of. He must be brought to Paranor if it was to be done properly.
She turned back to them and gestured at Trent Rowan.
Take the Athabasca and go east. Find our spies and get what additional information you can. Then find the boy's parents.
Am I to kill them for you?
The other asked, not quite managing to keep the disdain from his voice.
She walked over to him and stood close. Do you lack the stomach for it, Trant? Are you too weak to see this matter through?
There was a long pause as she held his gaze. To his credit, he did not look away. He was conflicted, perhaps, but determined, too.
I have never pretended to support what you are doing, Shadea, he said carefully. I would not have bothered with either the boy or his parents, but the decision was not given to me to make. Now that we are committed, I will do what is needed, but I won't pretend that it makes me happy.
She nodded, satisfied. This is what you do, then. Tell them that the Ard Rhys has disappeared and we are seeking her. Tell them that their son has gone looking for her and we are seeking him, too. If they come with you to Paranor, perhaps they can help find both. None of this is a lie. And in this instance, the truth is preferable. No one is to die outside these walls if we can help it.
Trant Rowan nodded slowly.
You will keep them alive just long enough to help you do...
What?
To help us find the boy, if it becomes necessary, and perhaps to help us make certain that Grian Ohmsford is safely locked away within the forbidding. If we can trick Beck Ohmsford into using his magic to seek them out, we can be assured that our efforts to eliminate the Ohmsford threat will succeed.
I think we should kill him and be done with it, Pison
Wentz declared, brushing her suggestion aside. He is too dangerous.
She laughed. Are you such a coward, Pison? We have eliminated our greatest enemy, our most dangerous foe. What do we care for someone as unskilled as her brother? He isn't even a druid. He doesn't practice his magic. He chooses to ignore it entirely. I don't think we need spare too much concern for his abilities. We are druids of some power ourselves, as I recall. The small man flushed at the rebuke, but, like Trant Rowan before him, did not look away.
You take too many chances, Shadea. We are not as powerful as you pretend. Look at how things stand with the Council. We barely control it. Our grip is so tenuous that it could slip entirely upon a single misstep. Instead of hunting down Grian Ohmsford's relatives and playing games with them, we should be consolidating our power and strengthening our hold on the Council. With Molt dead and Iridia gone off on her own, we need more allies. There are allies to be had, of that I'm certain. But they won't come without persuasion and enticement.
I am aware of this, she replied evenly, keeping her anger in check. He was such a fool. But watching our backs is our first order of business just now. We mustn't let any of those who have strong feelings for the former Ard Rhys become a threat.
There was a strained silence as they faced each other. Then, Pison Wentz shrugged.
As you wish, Shadea. You are our leader, but remember, we are your conscience, Trant and I. Don't be too quick to dismiss us.
I will do worse than that soon enough, little rat, she thought. I would never dismiss you without first listening carefully to what you have to say, Pison, she said. Your advice is always welcome. I depend on you to offer it freely. She smiled. Are we done? She waited until they had closed the door behind them before sitting down to write the note. Trant Rowan would depart Paranor for the Ravenshorn at first light, both he and Pison Wentz having agreed to accept her decision on the fate of the Olmsfords. In truth, they didn't care one way or the other about the Olmsford family, so long as they could feel they had put some distance between themselves and any bloodletting. They were strong enough when it came to manipulation and deceit, but not so good when it came to killing. That was her province. Hers, and Aphasia Wise. She sometimes thought how much easier her life would have been if she had never come to Paranor. Perhaps that would have been the wiser move. She would not be Ardrys of the Order, but neither would she be forced to bear the burden of its members' confusion and indecision. She could have practiced her magic alone, or even with Iridia as her partner, and accomplished much. But she had been desirous of more than that, greedy for the unmatchable power that came from leading those who could most affect the destiny of the four lands. Sen Dunsedain might think that the Federation was the future of the world, but she knew differently. Nevertheless, there were times when she wished she could simply eliminate all the druids and do everything herself. Things would be accomplished more quickly and efficiently. Events would progress with less conflict and argument. She was tired of shouldering the responsibility while being questioned at every turn by those she depended on to support her. They were a burden she would gladly shed when the time was right for it. She wrote the note swiftly, having already decided on its contents while listening to the prattling of Pison Wentz. The time for hesitation was through. If they weren't strong enough to do what was needed, she would be strong enough for them. When the note was finished, she read it back to herself. When you find the boy, don't bother with bringing him back. Kill him at once. She rolled up the paper and placed it into the tube she had retrieved from the Arrow Swift earlier in the day. Walking over to the window, she reached into the bird's cage and refastened the tube to its leg. The sharp, beaked face turned toward her as she did so, the bright eyes fixing on her. Yes, little warrior, she thought. You are a far better friend to me than those who just left. Too bad you can't replace them. When the tube was securely fastened, she withdrew the swift from its cage and tossed it into the air. It was gone from sight in moments, winging its way north into the twilight. It would fly all night and all the next day, a hardy, dependable courier. Wherever Aphasia Y was, the Arrow Swift would find him. She took a moment to think about what she had done. She had imposed a death sentence on the boy. That had not been her original intent, but her thinking about the Olmsfords had changed since she had begun her search for them. She needed to simplify things, and the simplest way of dealing with the Olmsfords was to kill them all and be done with it. She might tell Trant Rowan and Pison Wentz otherwise, might suggest there was another way, but she knew differently. She wanted all doors that might lead to Grian Olmsford permanently locked and sealed. By this time next week, that job would be done. Chapter 3. Tagwin crossed his arms, tucked his bearded chin into his chest, and gave a frustrated growl. If this isn't the most ill-considered idea I have ever come across, I can't think what is. He was losing what little remained of his patience. Why do we think there's even the possibility of making it work? How long have we been at it now? 3 hours, Pindarin? And we still haven't a clue about what to do. The boy listened to him wearily, admitted to himself that Tagwin was right, and promptly continued talking it through. Kyber is right about not relying on the elf stones. We can't do that unless we're certain that this creature has the use of magic as well. Magic that the elf stones can react to. I haven't seen anything that suggests it does. It might not be human, but that doesn't mean it relies on magic. If it does, and we find that out, Then Kyber can use the elf stones to disable it, but otherwise, we need to find a different way to gain an advantage.
Well, we have seen how fast it can move, the elven girl said. It's much quicker and more agile than we are, so we can't expect to gain an advantage there.
What if we could find a way to slow it down?
The dwarf grunted disdainfully.
Now there is a brilliant idea. Maybe we could hobble it with ropes or chains. Maybe we could drop it into quicksand or mud. Maybe we could lure it into a bottomless pit or off a cliff. There must be dozens of each in these mountains. All we need do is catch it napping and take it prisoner.
Stop, Tagwin, Kyber said quietly. This isn't helping. They stared at each other in uneasy silence, brows furrowed in a mix of concentration and frustration, a little more of the latter revealed on Tagwin's bluff face than on those of the other two. The night before, the Skatalo had appeared in the sky above the foothills west of the Charnels. 12 hours had passed since the horrifying discovery that the creature from Anachere had commandeered the airship, killed Gar Hatch and his rovers, and taken Cinnaminson prisoner. No one had slept since, though they had pretended at it. Now that daylight had returned, they were sitting in the sunshine on a mountainside trying to decide what to do next. Mostly, they were arguing about how best to help Cinnaminson. Penn might have persuaded his companions that they should not abandon her, but that didn't mean he'd persuaded them there was a way to save her.
It would be less mobile if we could lead it into a confined space, Kyber suggested.
Or force it to climb a tree or a cliff face, Penn added, where it couldn't use its speed or agility.
A ledge or defile, narrow and slippery.
Why don't we find a way to force it to swim out to us? Tagwin snapped irritably. It probably doesn't swim very well. Then we could drown it when it got close, bash it over the head with an oar or something. Where's the nearest big lake?
He blew out his breath in a huff.
Haven't we covered this ground already? What are the chances of making this happen? What in the world is going to persuade this creature to go anywhere we want it to go?
We have to find a way to lure it off the ship, Penn declared, looking from the dwarf to the elf and back again. Off the ship and away from Cinnaminson. We have to separate them if we are to free her.
Oh, that shouldn't be so hard, Tagwin mumbled. All we need is the right bait.
His face changed instantly as he realized the territory he had mistakenly entered.
I didn't mean that, I didn't. Don't even think about it, Pendaren. Whatever else happens, you have to keep safe. If anything happens to you, the Ard Reese has no chance of being saved. I know how you feel about this girl, but you should feel more strongly still about what you have been sent to do. You can't risk yourself.
Tagwin, calm down, the boy told him. Who said anything about risking myself? I'm just looking for a way to tip the balance in our favor long enough to free Cinnaminson and make an escape. In order to do the former, we need to separate her from her captor. In order to do the latter, we need to get control of the ship. Get him off the ship and away from Cinnaminson, then get us on the ship and safely away, Kyber summarized. She stared at him. That doesn't seem like something that is likely to happen in the ordinary course of events.
Well then, we will change the course of events, Penn declared. This thing might be faster and stronger than we are, but it isn't necessarily smarter.
We can outthink it. We can find a way to trick it into making a mistake.
Tagwin got to his feet, making a rude noise that left no doubt about his opinion of this proclamation.
I've had enough of this. I need to take a walk, young Pendaren, young Kyber. I need to leave this conversation behind and clear my head. I was secretary and personal assistant to the Ard Reese when we began this odyssey, and I haven't left that life far enough behind to feel comfortable with this one. I applaud your efforts in trying to save Cinnaminson, but I cannot think how they will lead to anything. If, while I am gone, you come up with the solution to this dilemma, I will be happy to hear all about it on my return.
He gave them a perfunctory bow, one stiff with impatience and dismay, and walked away. They watched him go in silence, and it wasn't until he was well out of sight and hearing that Kyber said, "He may be looking at this with clearer eyes than we are." Penn bristled instantly. "I suppose you think we should give up too? Just leave her to that monster and go on our way?" The elven girl shook her head. "I don't think that at all. When I told you I would help, I meant it. But I'm beginning to wonder what sort of help we can provide. Maybe we would be smarter to continue on to Taupo Ruff and ask help from Kermadec and his trolls. Whatever this thing is, the rock trolls are likely a better match for it than we are." "You might be right," Penn agreed. "But in order to find out, we have to go all the way to Taupo Ruff, then persuade Kermadec to help, then come back this way again and find the Skatalo, which is flying while we're on the ground. I don't much care for our chances there, either. If we don't do something right now, it will probably be too late. This creature won't bother keeping Cinnaminson around if it's not to its own advantage." He was remembering how Cinnaminson, blind but privy to a sort of inner mind vision that sighted people did not possess, had deliberately led her captor away from the spot where Penn and his companions were hiding in the rocks. He could not be certain that she had known he was there, but Penn felt in his heart that she had. Her courage astonished him, and he was terrified that it might have cost her life. "All right." Kyber straightened and leaned forward. "Let's try it again. We know what we need to do. We need to get this thing off the Skatalo and away from Cinnaminson. We need to keep it off long enough to take over the airship, get airborne, and escape. How much time would that take if you were piloting?" Penn thought, running his hand through his red hair. "A few minutes, no more, if the power lines haven't been disconnected. Even then, not long. A reconnect from any draw to any parse tube would be enough to get off the ground. Cut the ropes, engage the thrusters, open the draws, and you're away. We wouldn't have to worry about Cinnaminson until after we were airborne. All we need to figure out, then, is what it will take to get our cloaked friend off the ship." She considered. "Besides you." "But I am exactly what it will take, Kyber," he said quietly. "You know that. I'm what it's after. We know that much from Anachere. We don't know the reason, but we know I'm what it's come for." He took a deep breath. "Don't look at me that way. I know what I told Tagwin." "Good. That means you know as well that you are talking nonsense. Tagwin was right to warn you against latching onto any plan that exposed you to risk. That isn't why you came on this journey, Penn. You are the reason for everything that's happened, and you don't have the right to put yourself in a position where you could be killed." "That isn't what I'm suggesting." He couldn't keep the irritation from his voice. "The trick is to make sure that by becoming bait, I can still get away when I need to. The trick is in getting the monster off the Skatalo and me on, all at the same time. But I don't see any other way of making that happen if we can't deceive this thing into thinking it has a chance to get its hands on me." Kyber sighed. "You assume that getting its hands on you is its goal. What if it simply wants to kill you? It came close to doing that in Anachere." Penn looked down and rubbed his eyes. "I've been thinking about that. I don't think it was trying to kill me. I think it was trying to scare me. I think it was hoping I would freeze in place and it would be on me before anyone could help. It wants me for its prisoner to take me to whoever sent it." He saw the look of doubt that crossed her face and went on hurriedly. "All right. Maybe it was trying to injure me or slow me down. It's possible." She shook her head. "What's possible
is that you are no longer in touch with reality. Your feelings for this girl have muddled your thinking. You're starting to invent possibilities that have no basis in fact or common sense. You have to stop this, Pen.
He suppressed the sharp reply that struggled to break free and looked off across the mountainside.
They were wasting time, going nowhere, and it was his fault. What they were supposed to be doing was traveling to Taupo Ruff to find Kermadec so that he could reach the ruins of Stridegate and the island of the Tanaquil, gain possession of a limb from the tree, fashion it into a dark wand, return to Paranor, get through the forbidding, and somehow rescue his aunt, Grianne Ormsford, the Ard Rhys. Even without speaking the words aloud, he was left breathless and left with a feeling of urgency for getting on with what he was supposed to do. Yet here he was, doing none of it. Instead, he was insisting on rescuing Cinnaminson, and it was admittedly for selfish reasons. He looked up at the clear blue sky, then down at the foothills that banked and leveled to the shores of the Rab. He felt a momentary stab of panic as he realized that Kyber was right in her analysis. He was grasping at straws. But he couldn't bear to think of leaving Cinnaminson in the hands of that spidery creature, not feeling as he did about her. There has to be a way. Why couldn't he think of what it was? Why couldn't he think of something? Shouldn't his magic be able to help him? He had been chosen for this journey expressly because his magic would give him a way to communicate with the Tanaquil. If it would allow him to do that, shouldn't he be able to find a way to use it here? It had possibilities he had never dreamed of. The King of the Silver River had revealed as much. One of those possibilities ought to be available for use here. If he could think of it, if he could get past the feeling that his magic was small and insignificant, no matter what anyone said, spirit creature or human. If he could persuade himself that it was good for something more than drawing the interest of moorcats like Bandit and reading the danger signs in the flight of cliff birds, if he could just do that, he ought to be able to use it to help Cinnaminson. He was looking for a place to restart the conversation with Kyber when Tagwin walked back out of the rocks, brushing off his hands and looking less owlish than earlier.
"You can't imagine what I just found," he said.
Pen and Kyber exchanged a quizzical glance.
"Broadleaf rampion. Hardly ever find it in low country. Prefers higher elevations, cooler climates. No snow, mind you, but a hint of frost seems to favor it."
Both the boy and the elf girl stared at him. He looked quickly from one to the other.
"Never heard of it? It's a plant. Not very big, but fibrous. It secretes a sticky resin from splits in its skin. You break off stalks, crush them up, fire the whole mess to release the resin, separate it from the plant material, mix it with wart moss and albus root, cook it all until it thickens, and you know what you get?"
He grinned through his beard with such glee that it was almost frightening.
"Tar, my young friends. Very sticky tar."
So now they had a means, of sorts, of gaining an advantage over their enemy. If they could manage to lure it into a patch of that tar, everything it touched would stick to it, including the ground itself, and it would quickly become so bogged down with debris that it would have great difficulty functioning. Better still, if they could find a way to bring it into contact with something as immovable as a tree, it wouldn't be able to function at all. They spent the remainder of the morning distilling resin from the plant and turning it into a small batch of tar. They were able to find the albus root and wart moss needed to make the mix, and they cooked it over a smokeless fire using an indented stone for a bowl. When it was ready, they formed it into a ball, allowed it to cool, and wrapped it in young broad leaves tied together with strips of leather. The tar smelled awful,
and they had to consider the problem of disguising its presence as well as tricking the creature on the skate-low into stepping into it.
"This won't work," Kyber declared, wrinkling her nose against the stench as the three of them stared down at the steaming pouch.
"The creature will spot this in a heartbeat and go right around it."
Pen was inclined to agree, but he didn't say so. At least the leaf wrap was holding together, although it didn't look any too secure.
"If it's distracted, it might not notice the smell," he said.
"There's not very much of it to work with either," the elven girl continued doubtfully. "Not enough to cover more than maybe 2 square feet, and that's stretching it. How are we going to get it to step into a space that small?"
"Why worry about it?" Tagwin asked, throwing up his hands. "We don't know how to find this thing anyway, so the matter of applying the tar unobtrusively and in sufficient amounts to render the creature helpless is of very little consequence."
"We'll find it," Penn declared grimly. They started walking north, the direction the Skatalo had flown. Penn reasoned that the creature knew Cinnaminson's talent was most effective in the dark. It probably preferred to hunt at night anyway, since that was the only time they had ever seen it. They had been keeping watch for the Skatalo since sunrise, but hadn't seen anything other than birds and clouds. Penn felt pretty certain that the airship wouldn't reappear until nightfall. As they traveled, they discussed how they were going to lure their hunter into the tar once they found it and attracted its attention. There were all sorts of problems about accomplishing this. In order to get it into the tar, they would have to spread the tar around, then lead the creature to it and hope it stepped blindly in. It didn't seem too likely that this would happen. The thing hunting them was smart enough to avoid such an obvious trap. More to the point, one of them was going to have to act as bait, and the only one who would do was Penn. But neither Kyber nor Tagwin would hear of that, so another way had to be found. It was mid-afternoon, and they were high on the slopes leading up to the charnels when they finally began to put a workable plan together. By then, they were beginning to think about food again, remembering how good the rabbit Penn had caught 2 days before had tasted, and wishing they had saved a bit of it. They had water from the mountain streams and had found roots and berries to chew on, but none of it was as satisfying as that rabbit.
"We can build a fire," Kyber said. "That will attract attention from a long distance. The creature on the Skatalo won't miss it. But we won't be there. We'll bundle up some sticks and leaves to look like sleepers, but we'll be hiding back in the rocks."
Penn nodded. "We need to find the right place, one where the creature will have to land in a certain spot and approach in a certain way. It has to seem to the creature that we think we are protected, but really aren't. It has to think it's smarter than we are."
"That shouldn't be too hard," Tagwin declared with a snort. "It is smarter than we are."
"An open space leading to a gap in the rocks would be ideal," Penn went on, ignoring him. "We can coat the ground and rock sides with the tar. Even if it just brushes up against it, that would help." He looked over at Tagwin. "Does this stuff stay sticky when it gets cold?" The dwarf shook his head.
"It stiffens up. We have to keep it warm. Frost is a problem, too. If it frosts, the tar will harden and lose its stickiness."
There were so many variables in the plan that it was tough to keep them all straight, and Penn was growing increasingly worried that he was going to miss at least one of them. But there was nothing he could do about it except to continue talking the scheme over with Kyber and Tagwin, hoping that together they could keep everything straight. The afternoon slipped away, and the shadows were beginning to lengthen when Kyber suddenly gripped Penn's arm and said,
"There! That's what we're looking for!"
She was pointing across a sparsely wooded valley to a meadow that fronted a heavy cluster of rocks leading up into the mountains. The rocks were threaded by a tangle of passages that gave the cluster the look of a complicated maze. The maze lifted toward the base of a cliff face that dropped sharply for several hundred feet from a high plateau.
"You're right," Penn agreed. "Let's have a closer look before it gets dark."
They went down through the valley, into the trees, and along a series of ravines and gullies that rains and snowmelt had carved into the slope, watching the sun slide steadily lower on the horizon. East, the sky was already dark behind the mountains, and a three-quarter moon was on the rise. Nightbirds were winging through the growing gloom, and night sounds were beginning to surface. A wind had picked up, bitter and chill as it blew down out of the higher elevations. They were almost through the trees when Penn drew up short and pointed back the way they had come.
"Did you see something move just then?" he asked.
The dwarf and the girl peered through the dark wall of trunks and the pooling shadows.
"I didn't see anything," Kyber said.
Tagwin shook his head as well. "Shadows, maybe. The wind."
Penn nodded.
"Maybe."
They went on quickly and were out of the trees and across the meadow in moments, heading for the rocks. Penn saw at once that it was exactly what they had hoped to find. The meadow sloped gently upward into a jumble of boulders too high and too deep to see over. There were passages leading into the rocks, but most of them ended within a dozen yards. Only one led all the way through, traversing small clearings in which sparse stands of evergreens and scrub blocked clear passage. It was possible to get through, but not without maneuvering over and around various obstacles and making the correct choices from among the narrow defiles. Best of all, one of the choices led to an outcropping at the edge of the woods they had just come through, and it was elevated enough to allow them to see over the rim of the maze to the meadow below. "We build our fire in one of these clearings, make our sleeping dummies, and hide out here." Penn had it all worked out. "An airship can spot our fire if she comes anywhere within miles, but we can spot the airship too. We can tell if she's the Skatalo. We can see her land. We can watch what happens. Once the creature comes into the rocks, we slip down off the outcropping, skirt the trees, and come at the ship from outside. It's perfect." Neither the girl nor the dwarf cared to comment on that bold declaration, so it was left hanging in the stillness of the twilight, where even to Penn, it sounded a bit ridiculous. They went back through the maze to a clearing where the opening from the meadow was so narrow it was necessary to turn sideways to squeeze through. Penn looked around speculatively, then found what he was looking for. On the other side of the